You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. It seems the likelihood of leaving the EU with no deal is increasing. In fact, it's now 60%, according to Trade Minister Liam Fox. Also on the up in recent weeks has been the proliferation of apocalyptic scenarios about what this could mean. We're told that planes won't fly, that there could be shortages of medicine and food, and some claim that basic products like cheese, butter, and even sandwiches could become luxuries after Brexit. At the same time, leaving without an agreement would require a tremendous amount of planning and preparation, and there are many legitimate concerns and warnings worth listening to. Today we're joined by the IEA's chief economist, Julian Jessop, and senior counsel, Victoria Hewson, to discuss how the UK is preparing for such eventualities and how seriously we should heed these warnings about what this would entail. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. How do we differentiate between Project Fear and Project Fact?
Well, first of all, I think with a lot of the Project Fear stories, there's a common theme. I mean, they typically describe scenarios that are possible in theory, but very unlikely in practice. And that's because they usually make some combination of four assumptions, all of which I think are false. They usually assume that no withdrawal agreement under Article 50 means no deal at all on anything. They assume that the EU will ignore all its other legal obligations. They assume that the EU won't care about the impact on its own economy. And perhaps most importantly, they assume that there's nothing that the UK can do unilaterally to fix problems as they arise. So I think that's the reason why it's right to describe them as Project Fear. But in all of them, there's typically an element of fact. I don't think we can take it for granted that just because a problem is fixable in principle, it will be in practice. There's still lots of things that the UK government would need to do to cushion the impact of a no-deal scenario, whatever you care to choose that. And there is some reason, I think, to be worried that these preparations aren't taking place at the pace they should have been.
Do you agree with that? And if so, what would you be doing differently if you were managing this process?
I do agree with that. It's been very clear that even though the Chancellor of the Exchequer in the budget last winter made, I think it was £3 billion available for no-deal preparations, none of that has really been expended. There's been no evidence that anything really has been done. There's been a lot of talking, and I understand that civil servants have been doing a lot of groundwork in preparing for various options, but no customs officials have been hired, no additional work has been done at the port of Dover, for example. And even more importantly than that, no systems have been put in place and no support has been given to businesses who will be importing and exporting goods to advise them as what they can expect. The worrying thing for me about this, or one of several worrying aspects of this, is a lot of those preparations are the same for no deal as they would be for leaving with a free trade agreement. So, for example, when you're not in a customs union, you need to have customs declarations for goods crossing the border. And that requires certain things to be done differently at the ports where currently we really only do UK-EU trade. So especially the Dover-Calais route. So the fact that no investment has been made that would be equally useful and relevant to leaving with a free trade agreement as it would be to no deal really worries me that, in fact, what we are heading for is a sort of Brexit in name only, which, in fairness, is pretty much along the lines of what we have seen in the latest white paper.
Many Brexiteers were unhappy about the reshuffles that have been taking place. The responsibilities for negotiation moved from Dexu over to the Cabinet Office, and Dexu now seems to have assumed responsibility for kind of no-deal contingency planning. But on the other hand, you might say that that's precisely the preparation that needs to be taking place right now. Or is it simply too little too late at this point?
I think for the logistical aspects of, you know, physically getting goods across the channel, this, as Julian indicates, a lot of that could be within our own control. The actions that HMRC can take, the actions that DEFRA and other regulatory bodies can take to be very clear to businesses that we will be doing everything possible to keep the ports open unilaterally, as in we don't need a free trade agreement to eliminate tariffs or to suspend tariffs. That needn't happen. We don't need a mutual recognition agreement to continue to accept European food. We are perfectly content that European food will meet the standards on the 30th of March that are met on the 29th of March, and that can continue to be accepted even if the same isn't done the opposite way around. But as I say, businesses need to have some indication that that's what's actually going to happen. The example of medicines is another good one. We had some quite alarming stories triggered in part by an interview given by Sir Michael Rawlins, who's the chairman of the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Authority, the MHRA. And he suggested that in a no-deal Brexit scenario, we would have major difficulties sourcing very important medicines that people rely on. And he gave the example of insulin, which people with diabetes really need. It's critical for their health. And the point there is that he's right. If our government and the Department of Health and Social Care and the MHRA did nothing, we would be in severe difficulties in importing insulin from France and Denmark, which is where we get most of it from. But that doesn't mean to say that the MHRA and the Department of Health will do nothing. They can continue to recognise the marketing authorisations for those products. They can continue to recognise the manufacturing licences of the two companies that manufacture it and continue importing those critical medicines. So that's a really good example of scaremongering that has a grain of truth in it. It would be very bad if we didn't do all of those things. But for me, the takeaway from this is, why aren't all of these people who are raising all of these concerns and stoking panic and fear amongst people with diabetes and other conditions that rely on medicines, why are they not making a concerted effort to force the government's hand in actually taking some of these steps and publicising them?
I think it's fair to say that some, by no means all of these stories are, you know, clearly being pushed by people who have an agenda of one kind or another on both the EU and the UK side of the debate. And of course, it could be very harmful to our negotiating position as well, you might think.
Well, I think if you're looking at this with a cynical perspective, you might conclude that the government is trying to rule out the option of no deal. I think that's dangerous for two reasons. I mean, one is that it clearly weakens our bargaining position if the EU is left with the impression that we will accept any deal that's on the table, because the alternative of no deal isn't going to work. But also, there has to be a chance that we end up with no deal, not by design, but by accident, in which case I think it's very irresponsible not to be preparing for it. As it happens, I'm actually probably a little less sanguine about the downside risks of no deal than I might have been, say, a year ago. But that's largely because the government doesn't seem to have made that preparation that we and many others have been arguing for over that period. So the closer we get to March 2019, without proper progress having been made, I think the bigger the risks of a nasty outcome from no deal are. That said, it's not too late to turn lots of these things around. For example, even in a no deal scenario, it's perfectly possible to conclude an air services agreement that allows planes to continue to fly without relying on the Article 50 process. It's also clearly in the EU's interest to do so too, not least because these sorts of agreements are reciprocal. So that's one good example of something I think that should be relatively easy to fix. But the later we leave it, and the clock is ticking, you know, the bigger the risks that several very important things fall through the cracks, and at least part of Project Fear does actually turn out to be Project Fact.
Yes. I'd be interested to know, how much currency do you think the British public is actually giving these kinds of scare stories? Because, you know, is the mud sticking? We saw this in the referendum originally, that there were some ludicrous stories flying around. And when you hear things like, we're warned that we could starve to death, we could completely run out of food within the year, this being the country that survived the Second World War and the Atlantic blockades, you have to think that maybe there's a danger that the Project Fear will kind of overplay its hand and people will not take any of it seriously.
Mm. I mean, I think that is a significant risk. I mean, certainly the idea that we'll all starve by August if the UK had to become self-sufficient is nonsense. I don't think how anybody could present that as a credible scenario. And there's clearly a danger that, from the point of view of the Remainers, this backfires. I don't think anybody is going to take this sort of thing seriously. I suppose at least it does flag up some of the risks, and so it will maybe encourage some people to undertake contingency planning that they would otherwise have done. But as a contribution to the overall debate, I don't think it's helpful. I mean, there's evidently a competition to sell newspapers and publish blogs and so on with the most dramatic headlines. But I suspect that there is a risk from the Remainers' point of view that Project Fear backfires and people perhaps are too dismissive of those risks that are real.
I think it is interesting, isn't it, that a lot of the stories which do have a grain of truth in them, if carried to the most extreme conclusion. The counter side of that, though, is surely if it was true that we were in imminent danger of running out of food sometime in next year, wouldn't Tesco's and Sainsbury's have had to make some kind of notifications to the city and to their investors about that kind of thing? I would have thought, you know, if these are genuine, realistic prospects, the companies who sell food would have something to say about that. And while they certainly are, you know, they are publicising warnings about the risks of a no-deal Brexit, this hasn't been translated to real serious action. That, I think, does suggest that these stories do lack certain credibility. Again, the difference, I think, comes down to what the private sector operators can do, which is a lot. You know, in the case of medicines, we've heard from pharmaceuticals companies that they are getting ready by increasing the amount of warehousing they have available to build up buffer stocks in case there are logistical problems getting packets of medicines across the channel, which is all to the good and sensible, hopefully won't be necessary. But then we have the public sector side, the government side, where, as I say, unfortunately, there's very little clear information as to any steps that are being taken by HMRC in terms of alleviating the burden of submitting customs declarations and accounting for import VAT, which are, you know, really serious issues for importers when we are no longer in a customs union. So it seems to me that businesses are very much getting on with the job. We just really need the government to start taking some steps to give them a framework to work around.
Yeah.
Just to add, I think that's a very important point. One of the reasons why I'm relatively relaxed about the risks of a no deal is that a lot of the concerns are about policy choices that would be made by the UK government, not the EU. So, for example, there's talk of skills shortages if there are fewer migrants from the rest of the European Union. But, you know, that is a matter of policy for the Home Office to decide. And, you know, if we wanted to continue to allow large-scale migration from the EU, we would be able to do so. Similarly, there's a lot of talk about increased tariffs on imports from the EU or the imposition of other non-tariff barriers by the UK, which, of course, again, would be decisions that we would make. I mean, why on earth would we want to impose tariffs on imports from the EU rather than maintain the level of playing field required under WTO rules by lowering tariffs on imports from the rest of the world? So these are all good examples of things where the solution actually lies in the UK government's hands. But if we look at the lack of preparedness of the UK government now for no-deal Brexit, I think it's reasonable to question, you know, how quickly the government would respond to a no-deal Brexit scenario in practice to deal with these problems. I don't think, frankly, their credibility at the moment in that respect is very high.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't really inspire great confidence.
But again, turning to the more conspiratorially minded, the reason that the government is letting this happen is that perhaps they have no intention of even leaving the customs union at all. And really, this is why Treasury and HMRC are in something of a state of paralysis. They are still pursuing the proposition that we will stay in a facilitated customs arrangement, which would mean there would be no import declarations required. And therefore, they, as they see it, any investment in the systems and processes and resources for dealing with all of that would be a waste of time if we stay in a borderless free circulation arrangement with the EU. However, I think the indications are from the EU side is that they are extremely sceptical of the workability of a facilitated customs arrangement as outlined in the white paper, which would mean no customs declarations and the UK essentially acting as agent at our borders for duties on goods that ultimately end up in the customs union. So that seems to me to be a high risk strategy. But I think the risk is really that because we've done no preparation for leaving the customs union, that the more likely outcome is that we will therefore stay in a customs union.
There is some irony to the fact that in the internal machinations of the power struggles between the Cabinet Office and DEXU, it meant sidelining a white paper that seemed to be moving in the direction that very much the only agreement that taking what EU officials have said would have been acceptable to them, a kind of Canada-style deal, has now been sidelined in favour of one that seems to be cherry-picking the four freedoms.
Well, if you were to ask me what would I do now, I think, if you use the old joke, I wouldn't start from here. My own preference is still for what was until recently government policy, so some sort of comprehensive free trade deal along the Canada plus model, backed by streamlined customs arrangements and mutual recognition in areas such as financial services, but also a time-limited transition period, because I think there are lots of things that would need to be fixed by March 2019, and the chances of getting them all of them done, or even the most important ones done in time, is pretty slim. So in that sense, a no-deal Brexit is a risky second-best outcome. But I don't think it's the disaster that Project Fear would have us believe. It's still possible to do side deals on important things outside the framework of Article 50. There are good economic and as well as legal reasons for what it's worth for the EU to be cooperative. And we've got lots of things we can do unilaterally. So I am relatively sanguine about a no-deal Brexit, but it still wouldn't be my preferred outcome.
It's interesting as well that if you believe the Prime Minister and her staff on this, which I do, the main driver behind the white paper approach, and especially the facilitated customs arrangement, was avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. And that's really why the EU's offer of a free trade agreement was only for Great Britain, and this is where the very controversial Irish backstop comes into play, whereby the EU's proposal was that Northern Ireland would stay in its customs union and single market and therefore be separate in terms of regulation and customs duties, and ultimately in terms of legal jurisdiction would be separated from the rest of the United Kingdom. Now that's, as I say, that is what has driven the white paper proposal, was to try and avoid having to agree to that backstop. Because if we have this alternative proposal that avoids the need for border checks for anywhere in the United Kingdom, then you don't need to have this rather aggressive backstop of really what was termed as an annexation of Northern Ireland. But the counter side of all of this is if the white paper proposition is rejected, if a free trade agreement for the whole of the United Kingdom is also rejected, the options are narrowing. And one of those options, which, as we've mentioned, is becoming more likely as a result of all of this, is no deal. And who is no deal going to be worse for out of either the United Kingdom or any of the EU27? I'm afraid it's Ireland.
Yeah.
And this is why I think for Ireland in particular and the EU27, it's a very high-risk strategy. If it pays off and they do manage to get Britain, the whole of the British, the whole of Britain and Northern Ireland in a sort of de facto customs union and single market, then it will have paid off. But it's, as I say, it's a very high-risk strategy, because if that all falls down, and the politics around it are pretty unstable at the moment, and we are left with no deal, as Julian has said, we, the United Kingdom, have a lot of unilateral policy levers within our own control. Ireland doesn't.
So is the sidelining of a Canada-style arrangement because they fear it would mean basically throwing the Irish under the bus?
The position that the EU has on this is that if you have a normal arm's-length free trade agreement like the Canada CETA deal, there will inevitably be border checks. because free trade agreements are different to a single market and customs union, where you have neither customs declarations nor regulatory checks. And the EU's position, that the Commission's really quite rigid, legalistic position on this is, if we only had a free trade agreement between the United Kingdom and the European Union, they would have to have border checks between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Actually, we think, and this is endorsed by HMRC, it was initially endorsed by the Irish Revenue Commissioners and by many people in the field that I've been speaking to, it needn't be the case. Modern customs borders can be operated by checks that happen away from the border. And not having checks at the border doesn't mean not enforcing the border. You still enforce the border, you just do it by audits and ad hoc checks and inspections in the way that we do now for VAT, excise duty, and all of those kinds of things that already happen between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Going back to my initial question about differentiating between Project Fear and Project Fact, if we accept that some of these more extreme warnings are excessive, then on the flip side, which ones have real currency?
Well, ironically, I think a lot of the Project Fear stories do have an element of truth. If we take the one about the impact on the supply of food, I mean, there is clearly a risk that regardless of what we do on our side of the new border, it is possible that the EU will make life difficult on the other side, whether that's through additional customs checks or any other particularly non-tariff barriers that they might introduce. So we do need to be aware of those risks and think about ways of mitigate them. Indeed, there's probably, you know, a whole series of these Project Fear stories that I do think are worth digging into in a little bit more detail. We at the IA will be doing that over the next few weeks and months. We'll be producing a series of what we are provisionally calling fear checkers rather than fact checkers, but the aim is to sort of draw out what the risks are, to explain them, and in almost all cases explain why those risks are nowhere near as severe as they should be, as they're sometimes presented. But the key point here is that we're assuming that action is taken to mitigate these risks. We don't think it's necessarily going to work itself out just because we're trading under WTO rules. I mean, action will be taken certainly by the UK, and potentially in some cases by the EU as well. So it's important to identify what those actions are. The bottom line, therefore, is that a no-deal Brexit need not be anywhere near as catastrophic as some of the worst headlines are suggesting. But there are still some risks that do need to be taken seriously and mitigated, and the sooner we start taking those actions, the better.
Thank you both. For more podcasts, blogs, reports and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.